Welcome to another segment of Beyond the Grassy Knoll. And we have with us, I think, one of your favorite guests, and that is the Informer. I call him the I-Man, not to confuse him with Imus. He's got a whole lot better personality than Imus does. But we're going to talk about a couple of things today, and also in preparation for the two-hour conference that's coming up on December 20th. The information is on my website with regard to that, with regard to the registration and the CD sales afterward. So anyway, with that in mind, I want to thank you, I-Man, for coming back on. I know you were a little under the weather last week, and we ran instead of what this show is. I ran, I think, the first one we ever did, which was a two-parter on war powers. So anyway, I'm glad you're with us, and I know you're not 100%, so folks, you're going to have to give him a little bit in case he gets a little raspy-throated.
Okay.
So, yeah, welcome back, and what did you want to lead off with?
Well, what I can do is I have a little problem, like everybody does, and I've been trying to figure out, you know, I know the IRS is private, a lot of people don't believe it, but, you know, the mainstream people don't believe it, but even some of the patriots don't, but that is private, and it went on Manta, and you can go in there, and you can look at it, and it says a private organization, and yada, yada, yada.
All right, hold on a second. I want to let people know about that, too. I've mentioned it for other reasons, but you're absolutely right, and people have gone there and found that, and said, yep, that's there. There it is. Manta.com is the website. That's Manta.com. Click on if it's not there, the drop-down box for business, and you can put in the name of the company and or the corporation. In this situation, you put in what? Internal Revenue Service?
Yeah, I put in Internal Revenue Service and, you know, different ways to use it, IRS and so on and so forth. And it comes from Dun & Bradstreet, and Manta also puts it on there. And I was talking to Walter Buren, and he is the man who does the CAFRs.
That's right.
And he said that, yeah, he says, that's true, but it doesn't prove that they are private, even though it says a private corporation. And Walter had gotten from the GAO a document when they did the audit of IRS. GAO does the audit of IRS. And he said, so he just put on to the Manta site that GAO report, which proves beyond a doubt that the IRS is a private collection agency, not tied to the United States in any way, except in the agreement they made with the United States to collect certain taxes such as alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, government employment, merchant marine, and state employment employees who come under the Income Tax Act. That's all. That's it. Anything else outside in the private like us? No. So he put that on there, and he mentioned to me that it might be good if I contacted them to see if, because it did say that the IRS is a foreign corporation in the audit. The GAO audit actually said the IRS is a foreign corporation. But they didn't go any further. They didn't say any more.
What makes them foreign? Is it because they're based supposedly in Puerto Rico?
I have no idea. And this is what I'm trying to find. So I'll give you my original document. I had addressed at GAO. I knew Mr. White from GAO, but I lost his email address because he was the one that was instrumental in the telephone case on the FET to give me certain information and the Gore taxes and why the Gore taxes were non-constitutional, he used. And Murphy, who was the head of the GAO and the head attorney, actually sent his report to the Public Utilities Commission in North Carolina when we were fighting the FET. And I didn't have Mr. White's name, so I had to go to GAO itself and the website and contacted them. Now, the letter that I sent was to the GAO was, because the Internal Revenue Service is only a private collection agency and not an official United States agency, as indicated by many documents I have from the government going back to 1868 and forward, to the many service agreements the United States has with the private collecting organization, such as Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5967, the Reorganization Plan number 26, and the Agency for International Development, pursuant to Treasury Order Delegation number 91, and your own audit you do on them. I would like to know the country where the private IRS is chartered. I have inquired of the Secretary of State of three states, and all of them say by certified documents that the IRS is not authorized to do business in those states. And since the GAO was created for the old Treasury people, 42 Stat 23, when the independent subject treasuries were abolished by the Act of May 20th, 1920, Chapters 214, 41 Stat 654, semicolon, the private IRS is now controlled by the governor of the International Monetary Fund since the Bretton Woods Act in 1945 and under. All I need to know is what country is the private IRS chartered, and do you have a copy of that charter when you do the audit of the private IRS? And I signed it as a historical researcher. Well, what happened was I got a response, but it didn't come from GAO. It came from the GPO, the Government Printing Office. And it said, recently you requested personal assistance from our online support center. Below is a summary of your request and our response, and then they went through it, and it says, if this issue is not resolved to your satisfaction, you may reopen it within 7 days. Thank you for allowing us to service to you. You can update your question online by going to GPO Help and clicking the following link. And they gave me a link. And I wondered, what the heck is GPO answering my letter to GAO? So this has been going on since, 12-1-208. That's when I got their response.
Okay.
So last night, I wrote to GAO, and what they said was that I should write to the GPO, and I said, well, pray tell, how can I do that? And I explained, and they sent me an email this morning, and right before I called you, and they said, from looking at the thread of emails, it appears that your original question was sent to GPO, not GAO. We will forward your query to the appropriate office here at GAO. Thank you for contacting the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO webmaster. And I said, well, thank you. I can see that one can misconstrue that I had sent the original to GPO, but that was not the case. I really did send it to GAO and was surprised when the GPO answered, as they never do audits of the IRS. Here is the original that I had sent to GAO. And I said what I read to you, my original one, because in reading the thread, it did not have my original letter in the thread that they followed, all the way down to the beginning. For some reason, that got lost. I didn't do it, and, you know, I don't know where it went. So I just had to re-put that back, what I read to you, what the original letter was. So So I have it on my email now, and I'm ready to send it. So maybe by the 20th I'll have the answer.
Not that you would have to know this, although I think you do, and I haven't looked into this for years. But first of all, let me ask you this. An agency like the IRS, which at least feigns involvement with the federal government, should they have not, if they were legit, should they have not been supposedly created by Congress?
Right, and they weren't created by Congress, and there's a whole hullabaloo of stuff from there and goes back as to why, and when they're reading the government document and the government manuals, the 1100 and everything, it says they thought they had created the agency, but they really didn't.
They thought?
Yeah, they thought. It actually says in the book, in the government's manual, it says that Congress thought they created the Bureau, but they did not. All they did was create the commissioner of the internal auditing system of the Treasury Department. That's all they did.
Now, don't you find that a little specious? They said,
yeah.
Using the word, they thought.
Right, yeah. And so, what also is a lot of proof is, I have gone through, and it's on ATG Press, and I went through every title that I could find, Title 5, Title 31, Title 12, and looking for the agency, Title 2, looking for the agency of the Internal Revenue Service and where it was created and yada, 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 and I couldn't find it. And you could find everything under the sun, the Coast Guard, the agency, the Air Force, the whatever you wanted to call it, but nothing on IRS, nothing at all.
All right, now, where I was going with the second part of that question, which, I mean, you answered the first part, okay, but do we find ourselves also in a situation where so many of these rather modern agencies, if you will, like the DEA, like the BATF, all of them were never created by Congress?
No, they weren't. They were created by executive fiat.
Okay, so does that mean, is that different than executive order?
Well, no, because all executive orders are fiat anyway. They're make-believe. They're, you know, they have no basis in law.
Well, this is a good point because...
it's actually a basis in public policy for the President's War Powers Act because he can dictate whatever he wants.
Well...
Create whatever he wants.
Let's put it this way. Let me get back to the example I wanted to use. I have a friend up in Jersey, a lifelong friend, who's now starting to get it. And I'll be honest with you, the two situations that have eventually turned him to where I've been, the things I've been talking to him about, I'd say the last 5 years. One is the illegal immigration, and two is the financial situation. Because at least he's astute enough to turn around and say, is anybody in charge here? And,
right.
and the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
So now he starts to understand it, and he goes, well, what sense does this make? I said, none, unless you deliberately want to ruin you. I said, look at it this way. They're assassinating the United States, and he gets it.
Right.
All right, now, one of the things he asked me, since he's come into a multidimensional epiphany, and he was saying, what's with the executive orders? And I said, exactly. Now, even if the Constitution were something
right.
to us, which it's not, the fact that you allowed EOs kind of just throws everything out the window anyway.
Right.
All right. And he was asking me, how do you reverse it? And I said, well, it says, in the textbook, I guess what, Congress can do that, or it can be overridden by another president or reversed. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Yeah.
Now, if I rem-
and the problem was that when the executive order, that is actually public policy, and that is a law unto itself. It doesn't even follow the Constitution. And because it is public policy, and I've run into this on court cases where I was arguing a particular case in Jersey, and the judge seemed to be leaning in my favor. And it was a discrimination case on being fired. And they said that it looked real good, and the judge was talking to this IRS lawyer. Well, he's actually a lawyer that was hired by the company because it was so above the Princeton law firm's head that they didn't want to handle the case. And here it is, little old me, fighting this so-called big case that was so complicated that I had to hire a Washington, D.C. lawyer. And I knew the judge, by the way he was talking to the lawyer, that he was leading the lawyer. And, you know, I wasn't cognizant enough at that time to say, wait a minute, you're leading the opposing party and you can't do that. You're supposed to be unbiased.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. And he led the after three tries and attempts, the lawyer finally got it. I mean, this is how dumb the lawyers are, too. And he brought up public policy. Well, the 2 days before this trial hearing, I had gone over and found a case that the state Supreme Court just ruled on, and they brought up public policy. And I knew what he was doing. And once he said public policy, he then asked me, and the lawyer wrote, he orally said the argument about public policy. And, of course, the judge latched right onto that, which he wanted to. He gave him a way to come back to me. So I says, well, wait a minute, yeah, public policy is a constitution, isn't it? And I had found a case that said that public policy was the constitution.
Was?
Yes.
It was. Okay.
Was.
All right.
Was. That's why I used the word, not is, was.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought that in. Didn't matter because public policy overruled it, and even the case that I had got, which was a chemical company in New Jersey, a drug company, that's an employee there was suing for the same thing, and the court made a ruling on it, and they mentioned the public policy, and I went back into the old laws. I only had 2 days to do this, and I found the public policy was the Constitution, and I brought that up. Didn't matter. I lost. So,
well, that the executive order is a public policy, great, but that's still not very citizen friendly, is it?
No, because actually an executive order, if you look at all the states and all the United States being a private corporations, which they are,
mm-hmm.
Okay, now, remember in 1868 when Governor Worth and all of them in North Carolina, and they had said that after the Civil War, that under the Reconstruction Acts, all the states became territories of the United States, and they lost their state original status. that's on ATG Press 2. And that's why we put that. We found that in the archives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we had it stamped, file stamped, that it came from there. So that is the authorizing documents that we do have.
Now, I don't know if you're going someplace with public policy or not, but if you are, just hold it for a second, because I just want to ask you, so that what were known as states prior to 1868,
right?
Afterwards,
states. Uh-huh.
They were now classified as territories.
Territories of the United States, right.
All right, and everybody points to that year also because it was the year of the passing of the 14th Amendment. Did that have anything to do with this?
Yeah, because the 14th Amendment was really the Civil Rights Act for the Negro person at the time. And it couldn't be passed as a Civil Rights Act, so they quickly made it an amendment to the Constitution. That's all they did.
So
it's really a Public Rights Act for the colored people who were emancipated and had no place, no home, no country, no nothing. So the 14th Amendment made them subjects of the United States, and in doing so, when they took over the 13 southern states, they did it under military rule. But the Constitution forbid to have any one state having a higher authority over another state. So all the northern states then had to be included into the territories, and they became territories of the United States. And there's no separation of state and the United States because they're all under the corporate power. And every one of the states became like GM. All right, GM, you have five lines of cars, Cadillac, Pontiac, you know, Oldsmobile, which is dead now. So every one of the states were the same thing. But now they incorporated every one of the states as a territory, which they overruled, and that can be found in many documents, especially the driver's license, because every state has to abide by Title 49 of the United States title. And they all come under that for the motor vehicle laws, and that was in 1966. And so, therefore, they're all territories. They're not original states having their own private power, but they are controlled by executive order under municipal law.
Okay.
Assumed the states as a municipal entity of the United States.
All right, a couple things. The 13th Amendment actually gave, quote, blacks their freedom.
Well, yeah, that's why it was put in there in place of the original 13th Amendment.
Right. But now, you know, there's a wisecrack about this, which I believe to be true, that the 13th freed the slaves and the 14th enslaved everybody.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's basically because what they did, this is how they brought the original Bill of Rights into the states under due process of law. And that's why you now find under due process, under the 14th Amendment, all of the original amendments to the Bill of Rights. To the Constitution, and which is a separate law unto itself, for those elite and not the people in the states, because they never applied to the people in the states. And when you read the John Barron case, that explains it. The Supreme Court actually explained each Article 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is the Bill of Rights, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 10. And it explains it that way. And so, therefore, we're nothing but municipal subdivisions of the parent corporation called the United States.
Well, all right, now in the Barron case, real quick, and I want to make sure I got this. I believe I have saved as a Word doc the Barron case you sent me that once upon a time.
Yeah.
Now, if I got that right, what it said is that the feds basically told the person, the Barron, that you got no protection from the state. We grant you no protection from anything.
Right, right.
And you have any... Well, they told Barron he'd have to deal with it with the state, but he had no protection from the state either.
No.
And the state wouldn't give him any protection.
That's right.
So basically he swung in the breeze, too bad.
That's right, and that's why he couldn't do anything about the war that he lost and all that.
Right, but I mean, it stated there that, no, we don't provide you, as a private citizen, any protections.
Right.
Okay, so whose Bill of Rights is that then?
That Bill of Rights was for the power elite, the original 55 signers, and their posterity that they talked about. So if you wasn't related directly to Washington, Hamilton, Jefferson, Madison, Adams, and all them, you were out to lunch, because I've got the document of 207 inhabitants of Washington, D.C., that were filing a grievance against those people because they had no rights. They didn't have the rights that they thought they should have had under the Bill of Rights, which applied to, it said, we the people and the posterity. All right, we the people, not meaning the people in the states, but or the people that were absorbed in the state of Maryland and Virginia into Washington, D.C., into the den of criminals area there on the muddy flats of the Potomac River.
And I'll come back to this, but I've just made a couple of notes. In fact, I think you might have heard me almost stab myself with a pencil here. But
oh, okay.
As I was trying to pull it out from something.
Well, getting back to the
public policy.
What you find is, and we've been doing this, and Pat Lynch, the guy that does the IMF reads, he's far and above anyone else because he goes in and explains not only the code, but what they're doing in the code in relation to other code sections. In other words, yeah, I can read an IMF. I just get the books and, you know, spend $3,000 for the books and go in and quote right out of the book and put it down on a piece of paper and here, this is what they're saying you are and what you do and what you didn't. But Pat goes in and explains it more than that. Instead of just writing down verbatim what the code book says, he explains why they did it and how they did it. And he had filed a suit, not him himself, but a person that he was working with down in Florida. And it was an FDCPA suit, Title 15 U.S.C. 1692, A through K, or M, whatever it is. And it was against the city of Sunrise in Broward County, and the IRS agent has a pseudonym. And the guy in the state court under FDCPA, actually the judge ruled in favor of the guy. He got his $84,000 back, and he got his truck replaced that the IRS had seized, along with the city. So if the IRS was not a private corporation, they would have claimed immunity for the agent, and they did not. And therefore, that alone proves FDCPA Title 15 does apply to a private collection agency. Now, in Title 28, the IRS is bound by Title 28 FDCPA.
What does FDCPA mean?
Federal Debt Collection Practices Act.
Okay, thank you.
Or Fair Debt Collection Practices Act in Title 15. Title 28, it's Federal Debt Collection Practices. They just changed the F word to mean what they want.
Don't we all?
So anyway, we filed a case in New York, and the court refused to hear it, saying, it's a federal case, it's a federal matter. And it specifically states in K, that 1692K, that the state court will have competent jurisdiction. Any state court you can go to. You don't have to go to federal. You can go to state. And they kept it a state. We filed one here in North Carolina. And it said any state court of competent jurisdiction. I wrote to an attorney who does FDCPA cases in Virginia, and I asked him, what is a competent state court? He says, actually, any state court that has the dollar capacity to hear and give the remedy. So, if you wanted $75,000, you wouldn't take it to small claims court because they only have a capacity of $10,000 or $6,000, whatever it is in the state. You can take it to a district court, which is $10,000. You can take it to a superior court, which has got, $1 million if it wants to, you know. It will be able to give that remedy in that dollar amount, and that's what the lawyer said. So he went to the court. And the guy was in a different county, and the court said, we dismissed the case because you're not in the venue, you don't live in this county, so you can't do it. Well, the guy didn't know how to argue it, but in the North Carolina court rules, it says that any of the 100 counties, each county has a superior court and a district court, but all courts are state courts. It doesn't matter. This guy could have gone to Asheville, where the county where Asheville is, or in Boone County, or over to Elizabeth City, where some of the other counties it is in, and filed it, and it is in any state court. not want to handle a private case against IRS in a state court. So, in other words, the judges are protecting the status quo.
Correct, exactly.
Just like Lord D. Kelly did. And they admitted that. And the same as Judge Claiborne in Las Vegas, in Arizona, Nevada, when he started ruling in the 80s for the IRS because he got fed up with it. And they stripped him of his job, and he was no longer a judge and everything. And that's exactly what Lord V. Kelly said, that, you know, no court will sit back and say that they're not bound by the IRS because they know the IRS is looking over their shoulder at every ruling that they give.
Let me just stop you right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're talking with the Informer. You know, you can read his work on ATG Press. That stands for Against the Grain, ATGPress.com. You can click around the homepage on the Informer, and you can find out more about what's going on here. Also, and I would say, too, I mean, if you want to get a drink right now, go ahead. I'll do a little yaddy yaddy.
Okay.
But we're going to have a conference on December 20th. That's a Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And people will be able to ask questions. There's going to be a toll number, not a toll-free number, and there also is a chat room. You'll be able to interact with the Informer if you have some explicit questions. Also, he has three books for sale that are on the website, at least three books. We never talk too much about the other works. But at this stage in time, exactly, there are other things that are up there, aren't there, that are available?
Oh, on the books, yeah, there's... Which One Are You? And then there's Volume 1 and Volume 1A. That's a response to Which One Are You? Of which people wrote a lot of questions in. I didn't put the questions, but okay. I put the answers. And there's Volume 2, another response, because I got so many responses, questions from Which One Are You? And then there's another one called Would You Like the Constitution as a Source of Your Rights? The Big Lie, The Big Lie 3. The works of the Informer, reality, and then, of course, the new history of America.
All right. So take a look there. And again, be mindful of the fact that we are going to run a two-hour conference on Saturday the 20th. Now, I have some questions, but if you want to continue in the line you're going, go ahead and just...
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Did you want to know anything about the FET?
No, we're going to hold that if we can.
Okay.
To the 20th. When we have 2 hours, we can go into that.
Sure.
But I would say this, though, just as kind of a teaser, if you would. Do all of us have a better shot at getting some kind of remedy from FET?
Yeah.
Than we do trying to get out of the IRS?
Well, sort of, yeah, because the original document that I had sent to the phone company, they, the beginning of this year, they threw one at me. They've been giving me credit every year, every month. You know, all I had to do was write to them, and when I sent the bill and send it to a certain place, and they would give me credit for the FET. I'm the only one in the country that apparently is getting this credit.
So you have to pay the tax, but they'll kick it back as a credit against your next bill.
Right.
Okay.
Now, in the beginning of this month, this year, 2008, they said, oh, now I had to send them reasons why, after I already did, reasons why, and that I didn't have to pay the tax and everything. So I wrote to them, and I says, hey, wait a minute. You guys are getting paid to do all this. I ain't getting paid to do this. And if I got to write reasons and send you documents and reasons, and I want postage and stuff like this, I want payment. And I wrote to the Shawnee Mission office out there in Kansas, the head under the sales tax department, where you're supposed to, I was supposed to send this here and this over here. And, you know, it was so cumbersome. They wanted me to do this, you know.
They want,
I would go away.
That's right. They wanted you to quit.
So So I said, look, I get $150 an hour, and I'm going to charge you whatever number of hours it takes me to put this together, plus the postage and everything. And I told him, explicitly wrote in the letter, and says, Dale, in big red letters I wrote, you have 30 days to respond to this, and if you don't respond to this, I will take it as a tacit admission that you agree with these terms of this agreement, and you will pay me for what I have to do. Well, I never heard from them. And so every month I would do what they told me to do, and I would get credit for it. And I would have to then call the tar barrel office in North Carolina and explain to them, yeah, I said it, I did this, and I did that, and then he would give me the credit. Okay? So I invoice them every month, and it's up to like $677 now. And two of the top people there that I talked to, they said that they were trying to figure out a way that I wouldn't have to do all this jumping through the hoops and everything, that they were sort of like, even though they were the top people in the regulatory end of it, of Embark, they said that they had to go by what they're told from the main office. Okay, you know, they're just passing the buck. And I said, yeah, I says, you know what? I says, I filed an FDCPA against you people, and you had 30 days to respond with the validation of the debt, and you didn't. And I says, I did it once, and then I did it again, and I sent it to your office because I didn't send it to the proper party the first time. So now I sent it to the proper party, which is you people that I'm talking to on the phone right now. Oh, really? I says, yeah, don't you have it there? Well, I think we do. They never read it.
No.
And I said, if you read in there in title 5B, you will see that if it says you do not respond and give the name of the creditor and yada, 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 and verify the debt, that you are to cease billing immediately. Oh, really? I says, yeah. Do you have that law? Well, I have that law. Could you send it to us on fax it to? We'll give you a fax number, toll-free and everything. And could you fax that to us, that law? I says, I sure can. So I went on and I got the law from Cornell University, and I took it off and I put it on a fax and I sent it over to them. Next month, no bill. No phone bill. I mean, the phone bill was there, but it didn't have the FET. The next month, no FET. I said, huh, finally, I got somewhere. You know, even though I was getting, not paying it, at least I was, they were billing me.
Right.
And now, all of a sudden, they stopped billing me. They followed the law. Then, come right before October, they emailed or sent me a letter and said, look, we're going to restart billing you in October for the FET. Wait a minute, you already made admissions that you, I was right, the law was right, you followed the law. So I wrote back to them, sort of a semi-nasty letter, and said, hey, you know. And they said, oh, by the way, we're not going to pay you what you call an agreement because we don't agree that it's an agreement. I said, oh, really? Okay. I still invoice them. But they sent me, they says, okay, here's what you got to do. You got to send it out to the sales tax office in Kansas, and you got to put the, not the reasons, just write a letter saying you protest it and so on and so forth. And then what you do is you fax us the letter. Don't send it. Put it in, don't put it in the mail. Write the letter just as if you're going to send it and put it in the mail, but fax it to us with the cover letter, and we will take care of it and make sure that you get credited for the money. pretty effy cheap. Now, does that make sense?
It sounds like they're trying to keep everybody happy.
Yeah.
Including the pressure they may be getting from their side.
Right, right. But, see, the problem is, if they follow the FDCPA, all they got to do is go back to the IRS and says, look, we can't validate the debt. You know why they can't validate the debt?
Why?
Because in order to validate the debt, you got to give the name of the creditor. Are they going to give the name of the creditor as Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, or the United States?
All the above.
All the above, right. So they're sort of like, you know, that's why the IRS lost in the Florida case, because they could not validate the creditor on the debt of why they were taking this money from the man under a 1040 tax.
Yeah.
It would have to be, if they followed the letter of the law, they would have to say who the real creditor was. And they can't.
Oh, they can, but
Yeah, they could, but what if they come back and says the creditor is the Federal Reserve System, or the creditor is the Bank of England? Oh, now where's the contract with that to validate the debt? They can't validate the debt.
No, but I mean, the Federal Reserve people would swallow, but if they got the Bank of England involved in that, they'd start asking a lot of questions.
Yeah, because actually the Federal Reserve is part of the Bank of England.
Well, yeah, you know, and I have to laugh because doesn't anybody get the fact about why Alan Greenspan was knighted?
That's right.
I mean, how much of that was a smack and upside the head of all of us?
Right.
Holy mackerel. Well.
So what it is now is that every month I send them the same canned letter.
Right.
With a new invoice for every month, and now the only avenue that I have to go is to contact the judge locally here and see if he will handle the case, or if he's going to be a wussy and just pass it on and say, no, I can't handle it because it's a federal matter.
All right.
In other words, that's the only way that I'm going to get my money from them, although I could take it to small claims court and get it that way.
All right, and I tell you, I want to go in a little more depth about it, if we can, in about 2 weeks, because there is a precedent for this, and I want to go into that at that time.
Right.
If we could, in the remaining time, I want to bring you back, if we could, because, like I said, there's a train of questions that you raised within me by stating what you did, and if we could, going back to when the states became territories, the first question I would have is, well, how much of citizens do we lose further by having the designation of the states become now territories?
Well, the states became territories, and under their domain, their rule, everybody became a U.S. citizen because we're living on their property.
Right.
But who gave it to them in the first place? Nobody gave it to them. They stole the property. The Lord really owns the property. He gave it to us as stewards to overlook the property. And so really, no one, the original owner of the land is the Lord. So when the king and William took over England and said he owned the land, and now the Pope says he owns all the land in the world, he's just a false prophet. And who gave him the authority to own all the land in the world? Nobody. He can't cite one passage in the Bible that gave the Vicar of Christ the ownership of all the land that he can dole out to all the people in charge of tax. You know that the Pope was the first person that Montgomery found that caused an income tax?
Dating back to when?
Before the Crusades.
And so he could fund the Crusades?
Yes. Well, actually, he didn't fund the Crusades. He did that until he couldn't do it anymore. And then guess where he got the rest of the money to fund the Crusades? The Bank of England.
Around what time was this?
1355.
Okay, this is the Bank of England, though, before the Rothschilds.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's another whole turn of events once the Rothschilds gained control of that.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know what's interesting too. I have it here someplace because it's just a reminder. Because I think the symbolism was lost on all of us. But I think it was on October 1st, 1979, when John Paul II got out of the plane at the tarmac at Logan Airport and kissed the ground.
Yeah.
Should we take something?
He owned the ground. That's why he got down and kissed it.
Yeah, everybody thinks it's so cute. Like I had a bad ride, you know. Thank God. But in essence, what he kisses, he owns.
That's right.
That's why all the Muslims were looking on so lovingly when he kissed the Quran. I'm going, you guys don't get it.
Right.
All right. Now, this is very interesting about the territory thing because it would seem to me that there was a backhanded way to consolidate the United States even further under a centrally expanded government because you go after the supposed belligerent states. What were there? There were 11, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's what
13. There was 13 southern belligerent states.
Okay. What am I thinking 11? It's not a big deal. Okay.
Well, from Louisiana all the way over. Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee.
Because we always made the crack that there were 11 Confederate states with 13 stars on the flag.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there was 13 Confederate states, yeah, because that went from Maine. It didn't include Florida. Went from Maine to Florida.
Oh, okay. No, I'm thinking about the Confederacy, the actual CSA.
The actual Confederacy? Yeah, that, okay, that was, it starts from Virginia and comes on down.
Okay. I mean, I only kid about it because even if there were 11, 13 always is the number, of course, that they,
oh, yeah,
they use for occult symbolism.
Yeah, because if you actually look at it, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 with West Virginia, yeah. That was 11 states.
Okay, now, here's the deal. They put the states... Well, here's the thing. First, the federal government accepted back the belligerent states back into the Union as peaceable states. Then they turned around, and I think it's because they wanted ratification of the 13th and the 14th, or at least the latter.
Right.
They went ahead and they put on the states that had been brought back peaceably under martial law.
Mm-hmm.
And especially as territories or districts at that time.
Yeah, but, and the Constitution forbids to have any state
right.
above another.
Right. So here's,
and that's why they had to incorporate all the northern states.
There you go.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Maine, and all them as also territories.
All right, so while it looked like it was just a backhand again to the mm-hmm. to the states that had ceded, actually it got everything under it, right.
Lincoln wanted to control everything. It wasn't over slavery or anything. It wasn't over blacks being slaves.
No.
It was over money, all the money, because the state, all the southern states together, had three times the amount of revenue coming into them than the northern states did.
Now, I'm not a Lincoln lover or detractor, but could it possibly be that he was not all that much of a supporter of that, of those machinations, and as a result, lost his life because they wanted this to take place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a good article that I just got called a book written by a guy that I just got on the internet, and it's called Lincoln the Bastard. And it goes through everything that you were talking about and more.
Yeah, because, and this is another whole thing, but...
And he's also Jewish.
Isn't everybody?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's Jewish. You're Jewish, I'm Jewish, yeah. We just don't know it.
That's right.
Except for guys like Kerry and what's the other one's name? Wesley, who's the general?
Snipes.
That's Snipes. Please, that's another whole thing. No, Wesley Clark and Madeleine Albright. Oops, I forgot I'm Jewish.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
That's like Congress thinking, oh, we thought we created the IRS.
Right.
You know, this is like pregnancy. Either it is or it isn't. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, the thing is, with Booth killing Lincoln, there was no gain for that for the South. It all had been lost. This was after the fact. So to kill Lincoln had to be beyond something.
Yeah, because you know what it was? It was the Jesuits.
Yeah, that's what I know.
That's why when the Pope and they sent them over to take care of Brazil, they did not want any republics.
didn't want any government cited under a republic form of government, and that's why the Jesuits was sent over to destroy Brazil and the South American republics that were started, and this country.
And the United States.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I don't think they wanted it split. I think they just wanted it under greater central control. It became more monarchical and easier, more easy to deal with.
Yeah, that's what Patrick Henry said, is the fact that the Constitution was nothing but a monarchy. It was setting up a monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you read that in the Virginia debates. It's squints towards monarchy, he said.
You know, and this is another reason, too, just to blow up another patriot dream. That also all happened so the federal government made it very clear that there's no stake in a seed ever again. Forget that stuff.
Uh-huh.
I mean, am I right or wrong in that?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, these people talk about free Vermont or blah, 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 or free New Hampshire. It ain't going to happen.
No.
And there's another thing that you bring up, too, and I think this is important, that the states themselves, you know, they talk about states' rights, and at times it seems like they have some, but if you really push it with the federal government and run contrary to what they want or it wants, they'll go ahead and just cut the purse strings off. A good example would be, and tell me if this is valid, you know, because this is what I see. For instance, if you don't want to go along with certain federal DOT laws, well, you go ahead and fly in the face of them, and what will happen is the money you send to D.C. isn't going to come back for roads and stuff because the federal government will cut you off.
Exactly. That's what's happening here in North Carolina right now, is the Dorothea Dix Mental Hospital was moved over to Butner, where they're going to try to put another big bio lab. And it's just on the news last night that says that they don't meet certain criteria, and the federal government is going to remove all federal grants to the state for that.
Yeah, so the thing is,
they're saying, look, state, if you don't do what we tell you to do with this new facility with all these patients in it, we're going to take all the money away from you, and you ain't going to have squat. Now, what do you want to do? Do you want to follow what we tell you to do, or are you going to do what you want to do?
Well, again, I hate to isolate this, but I talked about this a week or so ago. On the ATG Press, I think you may have it up there now, certainly it was there, and that is this letter by Tom DeWeese, who runs this American Policy Center. And every so often...
I think they still put it on there.
Okay. Now, he comes up, and I mean, you know, he is the American Policy Center. I mean, that's this guy's enterprise.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about all the victories they're having and all this stuff. And I'm saying to myself, you know, the state can go so far, and then if it goes too far, it's going to get slapped down.
Right.
So I mean, whatever you have as far as victories right now, it's really kind of transitory, because the federal government will get its way. And one of the things that they use as a straw argument is this whole bit about not accepting a national ID. But here's where it goes back to what you had stated before, and the reason why your name, I'm guessing, on your driver's license, no matter what state you get it in, is in capital letters, because your state driver's license, is it not actually a federal document?
Yes, it is.
And that's one of the reasons I've said, who gives a crap about a national ID card, in a sense, because you've had one from the time you got your license, and the Social Security card is another whole thing.
That's right.
But, I mean, the number that I was issued in New Jersey in 1968 is the same number I have now, and I've had it in 7 states.
Right.
So what's the big deal? You've got a number, and it's a federal document. It's more than just a state driver's license.
Oh, yeah. And that is actually, if you want to call it the driver's license, has been the mark of the beast instead of the Social Security number.
Well, I'll tell you what.
I just tie them two together. And, in fact, you know, when you look at your Social Security number, the first 3 digits defines what state you got it from.
So you and I are both 149.
Yeah, it can be 145, 149.
To 149, okay.
And Colorado is 505.
All right.
I've got a book on all the Social Security numbers as to far as to what the first 3, the second 3 digits, and the last 4 digits is just a personal number to you.
Well, here's an example, and this is not going to be lost on you, I know. But my former partner, Harry, to the show, who comes on occasion, is a real stickler about showing his Social Security card when he goes in for making an application to work.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I know he's like this is because he came aboard with me up at St. Leo and caused a little bit of consternation, because he said, I do not have to show this card.
Right. right.
As a basis of identification for a job.
Yeah, because the old cards did have that printed on.
Right. But we've seen that now morph, that you can't go almost do anything without popping out your Social Security card.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, somewhere along the line, without asking us, we the people, little people,
mm-hmm.
that this turned into, basically, an ID card as well.
Right.
Now, anyway, let me ask you something. If you don't answer this, it'll still come down as a positive.
Okay.
Do you use a driver's license?
No, I don't have one at all. I gave mine up in 1985.
Okay. Do you drive roads?
No, I travel them.
Huh?
I travel them.
I'll leave it at that. All right. But the point being also, and I always wondered about this, and
you know,
that...
Got around tickets and everything from 1985 till when I had my accident in 1989. I had state police ID. That's all I had. And anytime I got stopped, I just whipped out my state police ID and I showed it to the guy and he says, "Have a nice day."
Oh, is this... Bye. Wait a minute. When you said state police ID, is this like when they give you a card?
I worked for the state police.
Okay. No, because... Right.
For 10 years as an advisor. And... there was only 5 of us in the state that reported directly to the superintendent of state police.
Under
his right-hand men.
Okay, because this is what I think you're saying also, and this is what happened to me when I was up in Bergen County, New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
I got a PBA card from a cop in Bogota.
Right.
And one time going through a yellow light, which I believe it really was,
uh-huh.
I got stopped by a cop in Bogota.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, it's a jump call, you know, wasn't being, I think, negligent. And I just pulled out the card. He goes, "You know Officer Graff?" I said, "Yes, I do." He goes, "Have a nice day."
Yeah.
So, otherwise it would have been groveling for several minutes. You know? But I mean...
Well, that's why when I got a speeding ticket through radar, I was the only car there. And he said I was doing 68 mile an hour, and I wasn't. I was doing 62 in a 50 mile an hour zone. And my radar detector went off, and I pulled it down, so I knew he couldn't get a lock on me because I was decelerating all the time.
Right.
But I had to decelerate from 60 to 50. And he turned around, and he followed me, and I stopped at a stop sign. He blew the horn, and I looked like, "Oh, who are you?" You know, I looked in the mirror, pulled across the road and stopped. And I was fishing out my... license that I did have at the time. Well, I didn't have the license because I had just turned it in. And he saw it and he says, "Oh," he says, I says, "Yeah," I says, "the guys are going to be chewing me out when I, you know." He wrote me up a warning.
Okay.
I was obstructing traffic.
There you go.
So they can do whatever they want.
Sure, and that's true, they can. Well, I won't go any further because we're a little bit out of time, and we're going to pick this up and everything in entirety when we do the two-hour conference on the 20th.
Okay.
So I just,
that'll be from 6 to 8, right?
That's it, 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay.
Eastern time.
Right.
And we'll have much more to go, and I mean, there's a whole bunch of things I'd like to cover, and I know people have questions.
Uh-huh.
So we'll leave that as everything you wanted to know and more, hopefully.
Okay.
I just got to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
Real quick, and it's my fault for asking this, but do you ever find it strange that Virginia is like the only state that won't allow you to use radar as you go through it? How can they get away with that? But they do.
Well, they can't actually. If you look at that, they can't stop you from using the airwaves. And it just so happens that radar is in the airwave frequency of garage door openers and everything. So
mm-hmm.
whenever I take, if I had used the radar in Virginia, the argument would be that it's my garage door checker.
That have to be activated as you went through this state?
Yeah.
So, in other words, if you're going to use radar in Virginia, make sure you keep your garage door opener with you.
Right.
Now,
in other words, there is a certain frequency, and it just so happens that radar falls in that frequency of which anybody can use, unfettered. How can Virginia, they use radar detector? Well, I'm sorry, but this is operating in a frequency that is given to intrusion alarms, garage garage door openers, and there's more, but I just can't remember all.
That's okay. And like I said, I want to get out of here, but I do want to say one thing. And even though it shouldn't be their purview either,
no.
Actually, that bit about the airwaves is more FCC than it should be any state.
That's right. It's worldwide. FCC is worldwide. Right.
And secondly, I don't know if you remember this, but this is a hoot. NORAD was doing something, I think, in Colorado Springs, and I don't know what went on, but something they did something militarily, you know, whatever it was. Uh-huh. And I think you know, thousands of garage door openers went up halfway.
Oh.
And no one could figure out what was going on.
Yes.
All right. Listen, do me a favor, Iron Man. Just stick with us for a second. I want to talk to you, but let me tell you folks that coming up now in the second hour, the Collins Brothers on their most recent article. By all means, stay tuned for that. You're listening to Beyond the Grassy Knoll.
Christmas time's coming, Christmas time's coming, Christmas time's coming.